permit issue.
He's got some stamps there. He's trying to, he's been asking me if I'd buy these from him.
We want the Idaho ones.
There's one stipulation. These have been inventoried, and at the end of the show and tell, I'm going to have to make sure that we have these.
You know exactly how many you have?
He knows he's talking to a bunch of politicians.
Probably all non-smokers, I would assume, mm-hmm. So we probably don't know what the tax stamp even looks like.
Yeah, what is the tax stamp?
It's on the back. Before I do this, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I know that there was some concern over whether or not we could actually generate the $7 million. And let me share with you some of the information that we have that gives us the kind of confidence that we know we can do this, because the department historically is very, very conservative. If we generally 99.9% sure of something before we even make a commitment. One of the things we've talked with is with the state of Washington as well as the state of California, and because of their enforcement activities, their enforcement group saves the state approximately $7 to $8 million a year. So in buy-in, we're talking $14-15 million. We're only talking seven here for the state of Oregon. Additionally, our pilot program that we implemented in March and April of last year, we reassigned a number of agents in for a couple of days in Portland, Salem, Southern Oregon, Eastern Oregon, to really go out and do some intensive inspections. Remembering, we only have one that's assigned to the whole state, so we pair them up with other agents, and within a month after that, what we call the sweeps, they had generated an additional $1 million in receipts the following month, because stamp sales had gone up because people they were being very careful to make sure that those folks who were engaging in counterfeiting and unstamped products were then buying the regular products. So we have great confidence in our ability to generate these dollars.
I just want to share with you my personal philosophy. Sure. I'm not speaking for the legislature or this committee, but you have a legal, unhealthy product that you're selling here. I don't think your mission is to sell an unhealthy product to make revenue for the state of Oregon. I think it needs to be policed, it needs to be administered, that's your responsibility. But I don't think you have any more responsibility to generate revenue than the OLCC does or the Lottery Commission. Those are unhealthy products that are state-sponsored, and for one reason or another, we have to provide them for the citizens of Oregon. I don't think we have to encourage the consumption or utilization of those products. We do have to collect the tax on the products that are legally purchased. So I agree with you halfway. And I think agency heads get fixated on the fact that I can make money on this program. And I think your mission is the health of the people of Oregon.
I think that's a very good point, Representative Hayden, and I think the thing that's probably troubling for all of us is that the lost revenue is revenue that we can't help other Oregonians with the Oregon Health Plan, and even though none of us probably at this table smoke cigarettes or use tobacco products, I haven't seen you chewing any lately. And I just think that it's a shame when, I mean, obviously, that other states whose taxes are not as high as ours, and that we're losing revenue that could help with the Oregon Health Plan and our cities and counties. But at the same time, you know, with the Internet, everything is changing. And how we address that issue, I was very flabbergasted to see that the because I don't click on to internet issues regarding tobacco, and I had not seen that that's the way you can buy it. So it's all a changing world out there as far as how we're going to protect the revenue we're entitled to, but yet make sure that we probably can do all we can to reduce consumption at the same time, but certainly not lose revenue for our programs that are in place to be funded by those.
Madam Chair, may I make one more comment?
Yes, please do.
It's my opinion that it is less expensive and more beneficial to hire these agents, whether they're state FTEs or contracted workers, to do the enforcement. It's cheaper to hire them, which would decrease probably consumption, than it is to hire doctors for the Oregon Health Plan to treat the people that get sick from the
That's product. Right. Has the state ever been tobacco free? Some states are alcohol free. Is there a tobacco free state?
I don't think there is. Madam Chair, I think that Representative Hayden has raised a really important point, and I don't want to let it go by if we've given you an erroneous impression. The Department of Revenue doesn't sell cigarettes. We administer a tax program. And what we're trying to do is make sure that if cigarettes are going to be sold and consumed in this state, that the appropriate level of tax has been paid. So we're not out there trying to encourage anybody to sell more cigarettes. What we're trying to do is make sure that for those folks who are selling to people who want to buy them, that they are selling cigarettes that have been fully taxed and are legal to be sold in the state. So I hope we did not give you the impression that somehow we're trying to push the revenue up by increasing sales of cigarettes. We're trying to keep the revenue stream where it ought to be so that it can support the programs it's supposed to support by maximizing compliance on those cigarettes that are going to be sold in the state. So when we talk about sales, we're talking about stamp sales, not sales of cigarettes themselves. Your point is very, very appropriate.
Thank you for that clarification.
Madam Chair, I did understand that clearly. However, the issue does become a little fogged because the stated mission of the OLCC is moderation.
Mm-hmm.
That is their mission. The stated mission of the Oregon Lottery Commission is to generate revenue. So we have three agencies with different missions, mm-hmm. and it gets a little confusing trying to keep the good guys
separated
and the other guys separated.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Senator Dukes.
You were saying that if someone wanted to buy cigarettes over the Internet, they could buy a carton, and that was the limit at one time. If they want to go to one of these other states that had the really low taxes, they're visiting, they're there for a wedding or something, and they want to bring back a trunk load, again for their own use, but because it's a lot cheaper there. Can they do that, or are they still limited to that one carton?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, they can do that. It is against statute to have more than a carton of cigarettes, either unstamped or stamped by another state. Now, are we going to enforce it? Probably not. But
that's a statute that says one?
And it says 200 cigarettes, and so 200 cigarettes is a carton of cigarettes. That actually stems back from after World War II, and the issues of the military and having military bases where the soldiers come home and they have their carton of cigarettes, and those are all unstamped. That's the genesis of that 200 cigarettes.
It has not been changed. Do other states have the same thing? What I'm thinking of is, I think it's gone now, but I used to have right across the bridge from Washington State in my district a little business that sold only tobacco products. And you couldn't walk in. It was a drive-thru. Because our taxes were lower than Washington State's. And there was a continual stream of Washington-plated cars that drove through. They apparently did well, and until the last time I think that we raised our tax. But do other states have that same restriction? Are we unique in saying you can only have one?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, most states have a ceiling of the number of cartons of cigarettes or the number of cigarettes that you can have. I don't know that number. I can get it for you if you'd like.
That's okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the thought occurs to me that 10 years or so ago, we had a good deal of angst over the sale of wine on the Internet to minors. and we did a whole
one lobbyist had a lot of angst over it.
All right. Anyway, we had a lot of discussion on that, and now we're discussing the sale of cigarettes on the internet to minors. So, actually, it wasn't on the internet, was it? It was by telephone.
By mail.
By mail.
By solicitation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
had a 17-year-old old or something.
You know, so I don't know what I don't remember what conclusions we came to, but some preliminary work has been done if we have to address this issue.
Thank you. Good comment. Okay, if you'd like to proceed.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you these, and I'll let you handle these three packs of authentic stamps, and they are Camels, Camel filters, Marlboro Lights, and Basic Menthol. And you'll be able to tell that they are authentic in terms of the stamp is generally right in the middle. It's stamp, it's sealed there, and it's a blue stamp. That means we changed the color January of last year as a result of the Master Tobacco Settlement. And so these are all pretty uniform. Every once in a while the machine messes up, but most of the time this is the way you will see it. And so if you look at that, you'll see that it's pretty clear around the edges. When you look at the counterfeits, they have it's been manually put on. And a lot of your counterfeits are manual, and if you look at them, you can usually lift it and you can tell the difference. One of the things we discovered is before January of last year, the Oregon stamp was yellow, and you'll see the yellow here. Well, these are all counterfeits. So these were counterfeited as early as last year when we changed the color of our stamp. So these are... Sure. Okay.
Senator Dukes.
This is what makes legislators unique. Everybody else will walk into a grocery store and look at the brand and the price. And we will now walk into grocery stores and look at the stamp on the bottom of the
box.
We do this for all kinds of things because this is what we get.
We just see the manager of the store calling out the Dukes family and saying, come down and pick up Senator Dukes. She's gazing over us last hour and a half. Conversation with cigarette seals.
These new glasses, I can't really see the picture.
Madam Chair, just one question.
They're
pretty light.
So that I can clarify, the 0103 amount that we are projecting in revenue, if I go back and what is funded by, and this is the 4-3 is the 9901,
mm-hmm.
and that shows 311.8 million. The Grocers Association provided us with some numbers. They were estimating $323 million, which was about a 12.9% reduction from the past biennium. Does that match your numbers? Down by about 12% in the tobacco tax collected, tobacco revenues. I assume this projected on 4-3. This is projected revenue, isn't it? 9901 projected revenue.
That's correct.
That is correct.
Okay. And incidentally, I didn't get the percentages to work out exactly the dollar amounts. They're correct within as much as a half of a percent, and I think when you're working with 311 million, that would be a little closer. But if I just take the cents per pack here, that doesn't work out exactly. But I assume it's just some rounding there. But a half a percent on $312 million is a lot of money. It runs most all of my counties in my district for what you're talking about there. The other concern that I've got is that the Grocers Association feels like that there's an actual reduction in tobacco consumption in the state by something in the vicinity of about 2%. And so we're down by about 13%. That means that there must be at least 11% of, and that would match your number, come very close to your number, But that was through 01. That's through the 99-01 fiscal year. They're estimating that, and I don't know what the governor is using for revenue, and I understand these figures may have come from the legislative revenue. They're estimating an additional from the 97-99, they're estimating an additional 11.63% reduction, which brings a total of 23.04 reduction in taxes. When in effect, what's happened is that, again, they're estimating that there's only a 2% reduction in tobacco consumption in the state. And so actually the amount of either gray market or bootleg black market would be closer to 20% than it would be to 12%. Without looking at the numbers, do you want to make any comment on that, Director Archenko?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the forecast numbers are from the Office of Economic Analysis. They do all the forecasting. And I believe that we ought to check with them to make sure what's gone into their forecast number. As John said earlier in his presentation, we worked with the Health Division to learn what the level of the actual reduction in smoking in the state is, and I think you said it was around 4%?
3 to 4%.
3 to 4% was the estimate we were getting from the Health Division. So the information is something that you have to sort of triangulate to get at in any event, but we've been working with resources within state government to try to do those estimates.
Thank you very much. I would like to zero in on that, and I'll share these numbers, but it looks to me like there may be a larger percentage of actual non-compliance, non-compliance is just one way or the other. I got to wash my fingerprints off.
Okay, John, if you'll proceed.
Are you through with
you? I am. Thank you very much. I'll share these numbers with Director Archenko and John in a few minutes.
Other than that, I think that concludes my presentation.
Okay. And then we probably need to get into the questions.
Yes. So, Madam Chair, what we had planned to do was I would ask Susan Browning and Jack Ogami to come up and address the questions that came up yesterday that were related to processing and income tax program. And then once you've had the information you need from them, also to answer any other questions that have occurred to you from that, then Randy Evers will come back and talk to you about property tax and answer those questions from yesterday.
Sounds fine.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Thank you, John, for your testimony. Bridget, you may sit in that chair right there if you'd like.
Yeah, get a feel for the other side of the table.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Browning, with the Department of Revenue. And the first question I wanted to respond to was Representative Hayden.
Question you had.
Okay.
All right. I can't remember which are the legal ones, which are the other.
That makes a difference if you're going to take them.
I think those are the legal.
Okay, these are the legal. Yeah. They just brush right off. They're just.
Maybe that's the illegal one.
I don't know.
Yeah.
These are the legal ones?
Yeah.
They brush off pretty easy, don't they?
Yeah, they're just wafer thin. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, they both have my fingerprints all over them.
You're in trouble. Okay. Go ahead, Susan.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, you asked what the cost of Department of Revenue's administrative costs for running the paper checks, and then how does that compare to the opportunity cost that taxpayers would lose on forestalling the interest? And for 99, the Department of Revenue's cost of running checks, actually issuing checks back to the taxpayers, was $781,000. And then we asked your Legislative Revenue Office to run the analysis for us on what the cost to taxpayers of holding the kicker refunds until April, when they would apply them as a tax credit, And we have three assumptions in here, so we can run these numbers anyway. But what Ed Waters from Legislative Revenue based it on was that the refunds would go out on November 15th of this year, if there's a kicker. So that's one of the dates. The other assumption is the average date the credits would be applied, if we had a credit instead of a refund, would be April 1st. And then he figured the percentage rate 8%, which might be kind of high. But based on all those assumptions, it would be $10.04 million in interest. And I did a quick calculation. If it were 6% with those other two assumptions the same, and that takes it down to $7.5 million.
Okay, so that's a pretty clear answer. There's not much equivocation there. And it's really in the interest of the taxpayers to have their refund back quickly by mail.
Does that answer that question, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden?
It answers it for me.
It answers it for me as well. Thank you, Susan.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It depends on how you view that. There are programs that are of great interest to the people of the state of Oregon that could be funded with $10 million.
Okay, further responses?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the second question was Senator Dukes asked about compliance of non-residents along the border. The question was, how are Washington residents complying with the need to pay Oregon income tax when they live in Washington State and commute into Oregon to work? And we really don't have any hard and fast data on that, but I talked to a staff or managers in the Portland office that really have some experience in that. And it's pretty much what you'd think. They think that compliance is about the same for non-resident as resident wage earners, because the money's coming through the withholding system, similar to what we talked about yesterday. So that's probably not an issue. There probably is they think there may be compliance issues for self-employed people, and then for the smaller schedule fee business persons who may be advertising in Portland papers and coming down to take jobs doing some kind of work, like tradespeople and those type of activities. And those businesses that are more cash basis, obviously there's going to be more of a compliance issue.
I just follow up on that. The Construction Contractors Board gets around that by making sure that when they advertise with their ID number, their Oregon ID number. Is there any attempt to coordinate these activities, the Construction Contractor Board activities? Let me back up here. I recognize that everything that you've got is extremely confidential and protected with all sorts of statutes to make sure that it stays confidential. That having been said, the information the Construction Contractors Board is not quite so sensitive. Do you folks at any time ever merge match with the Construction Contractors Board those lists of names of people who are along the borders of the state, out of state, who have Construction Contractors Board licenses? Do you ever do that?
Mr. Chair, we have done work in comparing data with the Construction Contractors Board for Oregon residents. We've been sensitive about dealing with Washington resident issues and because of the relationship between the two states.
I appreciate, and I don't want to raise the border war issue, but go ahead, Senator Dukes.
I was going to say, but they're not so sensitive. I remember being really surprised to find out that Washington employees or companies had to collect sales tax for the state of Oregon. And I had some businesses, or one in particular, that was getting fined by the state of Washington for not collecting a sales tax because they were selling products in Oregon and delivering them to Washington. And they were supposed to, according to Washington law, supposed to be collecting the sales tax and sending it to Washington. And apparently we have some sort of agreement that, we'll enforce that and we'll make those companies do that. So if we're helping them collect their sales tax, it seems like they ought to be, we shouldn't be quite so concerned about having their help in collecting our income tax.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it's an excellent idea. We mentioned yesterday about our attempts have primarily in this area have been around education, the small business workshops in the Portland area and also in Washington area, and as well as you know, working with employers, which is less of an issue because most of the money seems to be coming through for the withholding system. But I think Representative Butler's an excellent concept, and we can certainly pursue that because it does sound like they're, the issues that the staff are seeing are more around the trades arena where people are coming down and doing that kind of work, and we can work as Construction Contractors Board, and we'll talk with them about that. See what
I would like, it's Susan, right?
Yes. I would
like to see us expand that to all of the state licensing board. Not just I'm not trying to aim at construction contractors, folks, but being sensitive, and I live on one of those border war issues, and what will happen is regularly the state of Idaho will attempt to come forward and their sales tax folks and crash in the doors of a Oregon business and say, we think that you've been selling to Idaho people, we want to see your records. And it's not a very pleasant situation, and it makes for some bad feelings in the communities both ways, and it damages our retail businesses, and it damages our reputation. So like Senator Dukes, I would like to make sure that not that we, you know, go an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. We'd all be blind and toothless at that point. But I just assume that we, an emerge match program on your state licensure boards would be a slam dunk to find out, to just screen all licenses that have Idaho, Nevada, California, Washington addresses on the licensee, and then make absolutely certain that those folks are filing Oregon income tax returns. Again, your records are not in any way compromised, but the other records, which are public records available for inspection to see who applies for those licenses to do business, would be open to us. That never have done that, so far as we know.
Mr. Chair, not that I know of, and it's a good concept to follow through, and we will definitely look into it. And it could be follow up in line of the education concept we have. Once we identify people who we believe may be in that kind of situation, we can send them letters just pointing out their requirements and working with them. It doesn't need to be punitive. It could be more educational. Because sometimes I think people don't realize, I know we have that issue with employers, they don't realize their obligation if they're new in the area. And sometimes these people may not as well. So we'll work with that.
You're being very kind and generous because they are smart enough to come over and license in Oregon. I think that's a bigger point. And I'm not asking it to be punitive, but I'm asking it to be compliant.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And I've pivoted off a different question, so thank you. Mm-hmm. Other responses?
I believe that were the only two questions that dealt with personal income tax. I know Jack has a follow-up there. Response from
Jack. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Ogami, the department's information processing division administrator. Yesterday, Chair Butler had asked a question on our chart on page 1-56, which shows the graph, the annual cost per document filed. And Chair Butler had asked if we could go back and calculate a similar graph projecting our auditing and collecting costs versus our personal income tax returns filed. We were able to. This chart completed yesterday, and walk through this chart. We start out with 1998, where we've got our cost per return at $1.06. That's the cost of processing a personal income tax return through our processing center is in the blue area. The red area is our cost of our auditors, which are our personal income tax auditors and their supervisors at $3.43. And the yellow area is the cost of our personal income tax collection staff and their supervisors at $2.03. So if you follow this chart from 1988 through the year 2000, the cost of processing the return, this is the total cost of processing the returns that has gone down because of the mix. The addition of electronic filing has gone down from $1.06 to 86 cents. We've added more auditors, so the cost of auditing per return has gone up to $3.99. And the cost of collecting has gone up from $2.03 to $2.08. and I assume that's primarily because we've added more auditors and collectors over those 3 years.
Thank you, Jack. That's a 41-cent increase. Which is a 6.3% increase over 2 years, or in the third year. But with the cost of the returns dropping nearly 20%, the actual processing of returns. Thank you,
Chair.
Yes, Representative Hayden is recognized.
Does the term collections mean just routine collection, or is that police collection, coercive collection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, the term collections refers to our collections and filing enforcement unit. They're primarily telephone collections people. They're not field collection staff.
So the 86 cents in 2000, the blue, the 86 cents is the cost for 90% of your returns, and the 399 and the 208 are the costs that are applied to 5 or 10% of the returns, and you just spread those across all the 100% to get that figure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct. We just took the common denominator being the number of personal income tax returns filed, divided our cost by that to sort of give a scope as to what the cost would be per return filed.
Well, I suppose it works out, Mr. Chair, I suppose it works out economically that you get more return from auditing and collecting than if you didn't, but seems like a huge amount of it, of the expenses spent on auditing and collecting. What would happen if you never audited or collected at all and you just processed the returns?
Susan, to take that one. That's what you learn. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, this is a little bit similar to the previous discussion we had about the compliance by non-residents in Washington who live in Oregon. We probably are losing some money from not following up on suggestions similar to Representative Butler's, because we are doing a lot of compliance work with those residents of Washington. And if we eliminate the audit and collection function, our costs would go down dramatically, as that points out. But also, over a period of time, the compliance would start to fall off as well. Jack shared with me an interesting little item he found on the March 6th Today Show, I think. Today Show did a survey of people, I think 1,000 people, and asked how many people have cheated on their taxes. Well, only 6% admitted they cheated on their taxes, but 40% admitted they would cheat if they didn't think they could get caught. And that ranges from everything of, like, you know, you're tinkering with your charitable contributions up to more aggressive things. But part of the
people behind you smiling. We're going to pull the people in this room.
I'm sure everybody here is part of the 60% who would never cheat, Representative Hayden. But I think that was a little interesting statistic, because I think it validates what we see, is that it is a voluntary system, and we do depend totally on the voluntary compliance, not totally, but largely on voluntary compliance, as those figures, the graphs we provided yesterday showed. But behind that, there's also the possibility that there will be enforcement, that your return will be audited, it will be reviewed, and that we try to make that as fair, legal, easy as possible for the taxpayer, but it could happen. And then we follow up with the collection piece of it for those people. So it is important to have the audit and collection function. It's kind of the little three pillars we presented yesterday: education, assistance, and enforcement. We can educate people, we can assist them, but there's always this temptation by many people to try to evade paying taxes, because there's a lot of monetary incentive in it. It's more money in your pocket if you don't have to pay as much tax. So I think it just makes good business sense to a lot of people. If they could pay less tax, they could have more money, and if no one's going to catch them, they may do that.
Continuing that discussion, two things. I'm wondering how you determine where where the break-even point is, or the best bang for the buck, actually. If you doubled it to $12, would you get that much more money? If you cut it to $3 per return, would you get that much less money? How do you determine how many fangs you're going to show to get general deterrence, as one of our other agencies talks about?
Chair Butler, Representative Hayden, that's a really tough question. It's one that we balance and deal with all of the time. First of all, we try hard not to show fangs until we really have to, with people who are very resistive to our other attempts to work with them and resolve their tax debt. I think it was Representative Butler, we talked with him after the hearing yesterday, and was talking about at some point it does become a point of diminishing returns. You add more staff, we will probably get more money back, but not the same dollar return that we would for adding an incremental part here. For adding one revenue agent, at some point maybe you get $10. Down the road, maybe you get $2 for their salary. So that's something we try to balance all the time as well. And we really firmly believe in the balanced approach by emphasizing voluntary compliance and making it easier for people and giving them options, giving them information to get most of the people in the system and staying in the system on their own. That's really what the long-term health of the system depends on. That it really does, because the state will, through your funding and your approval, will never have enough resources to ensure that there's 100% compliance by enforcement. It needs to come through enhancing and helping people understand what their money goes for, so that they support what all of you have funded and what we're working for. So there's a good feeling about paying taxes as much as possible, and something that people will not try to avoid or try to work around, because we don't want to be in such a situation that we have to just rely on enforcement to get the money in. That's not a good way to reckon it. So there's not a hard and fast answer I believe I can provide for you. I think, as we talked about the packages that the governor's asked us to provide, that's a lot of the discussion we've had, is that could we commit to bringing in more revenue if you gave us more positions? And we really want to be able to under-promise and over-deliver for you and really provide a good long-term strategy for the tax system. It's more about what we do, not what we do right now, but where are we long-term.
True accountants, very conservative.
I like that answer a lot. Thank you.
Relative to the information, that the actual audit costs in 2000 versus 1998 are up by 16.3%. I assume that's part of the package that we approved last time. Mm-hmm. And I think we're about halfway there, Jack. What I would like to have, and this is where I was headed, was could we have, relative to the revenue on the audits, actual revenue per audited documents in 98 versus the revenue being collected on audited documents in 2000. And the same with collection accounts. The number of collection accounts in 98 and the percent of collection on each of those accounts. And the same with the and I think that's going to show probably when you look at the number of accounts and the percentage of collection on each of those accounts in 2000, that's going to show the results. It's going to magnify the results of your audit work, I believe. So I if I could just get one more iteration of that, I would appreciate it. Next item. That was it. All right.
I think that all of the income tax and processing related questions, unless you have any others that have occurred to you since yesterday.
Are you going to speak in memo? You ready?
Yes. I can provide that in writing. Okay. Well, if there's nothing more at this time for Jack and Susan, I'll ask Randy Evers to come up and address the property tax questions that were asked yesterday.
Chair, what time is the House going to session?
11 o'clock today.
11, okay.
No, wait a minute. 10:30.
10:30.
Oh, you need
10, to go 10:30. It shows here 10:30 session. Let's see. Is it the 10:30 to 11:30 session?
Mr. Chair, we can do those tomorrow morning before your work session, if that would be more convenient for the committee.
Okay. And the other issue, Elizabeth, was just I would like to know the number of accounts that had been audited as a result of this 16.3% too. if I could.
The number of new audits that were opened after
audits,
we got the
total audits package. In these years, and that will, if you'll give me the total audits, then we'll know before the enhancement package and now the number of audits that we, and that'll, again, that will amplify the information. I think it's gonna show what's happening in the drafts and shots. Okay. And tomorrow morning we.
And we'll get the property tax question tomorrow.
All right. Thank you very much.
Will that give you enough time for your work questions? If we take about a half hour.
Mr. Chair, we've got some public testimony scheduled for tomorrow, and then I was hoping to go into a work session. It should, assuming that outstanding issues can be resolved. If not, we can always carry it over to Monday.
Okay.
Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and stand at recess until tomorrow. Even time.